is hosted by the Quantum Foundation Group and is organized in collaboration with the Southwestern Ontario Philosophy of Physics seminar series. So today, as you saw, we will have a philosophy, but also technology. That is a new part of our seminars, because we have this video link that we are trying now for the first time. And so today's speaker is David Baker. So David got his PhD in 2008 at Princeton University under the supervision of Professor Halvorsen. So now he is assistant professor at Michigan, University of Michigan. So he's interested in philosophy of science, and in particular in the philosophy of field theory, which apparently is related to today's talk. So,
yeah.
Dave.
All right, thank you. So this is indeed a talk in the philosophy of quantum field theory. Let me just start out by giving you a real ballpark sketch of where I'm going here. So, the title being Antimatter Without Antiparticles. What I want to show you is that you can have antimatter without appeal to the concept of a particle in those domains in quantum field theory where it looks like that concept kind of seems to break down. So the goal here is going to be to show, well, a standard sort of heuristic definition of antimatter is to first define what it is for something to be an antiparticle, and then say, well, antimatter is matter made up out of antiparticles. But the goal of this work, this joint work with Hans, is to show that, in fact, you can have a definition of antimatter that doesn't appeal in any way to the concept of a particle and can therefore apply even in those cases where, at least debatably, the particle concept doesn't apply in quantum field theory. So you can, in effect, have antimatter fundamentally even in cases where fundamentally there are no particles. So here's the direction it's going to go. It's a little bit circuitous, but to start with, I'm going to talk about this naive picture that comes from sort of introductory remarks in textbooks on quantum field theory about what counts as antimatter, what the real definition of the notion of antimatter is. I'll look at a couple of puzzles about that naive picture. The first one, of course, is this puzzle about how the particle picture breaks down in the interacting versions of quantum field theory. But there's another puzzle about basically which physical quantities get their values reversed in the transition, the transformation from matter to antimatter, what we call the charge conjugation transformation, and what it means to say that they take on the opposite values. To explain these sorts of, to basically work out these puzzles, we're going to have to look at a picture of super selection theory that was introduced by Doplicher, Hogg, and Roberts, which we call DHR. So to start out with, we're going to look at some of the ways that group representation theory makes particle physics so easy, and yet the ways in which it can look kind of mysterious or sort of tacked on to the formalism of quantum field theory. It can be sort of mysterious why it is that group representation theory works so well in quantum field theory. Well, I'll then show you some things about this DHR approach to superselection theory, which this approach does a really good job of explaining why group representation theory does such a good job of explaining things like the charge structure of a quantum field theory. I'll say a few things in particular about the DHR approach. Unfortunately, there are some aspects of it that are a little bit unrealistic and idealized, so some caveats will have to come in at this point. But after doing that, then, I'll mention some foundational remarks, which are really the contribution that Hans and I in particular have made, as opposed to these great mathematicians, DH and R. Those are the contributions we've made to the project, basically to show that it gives us a way to understand antimatter without antiparticles. Okay, so step one, the textbook treatment of antimatter, right? So you pick up Peskin and Schroeder, you pick up pretty much any regular textbook in quantum field theory. And the first thing they're going to do is start out with describing some solutions to free relativistic wave equations like the Klein-Gordon equation and the Dirac equation. And this is where the concept of antimatter sort of comes in, because they'll say, well, look, these relativistic wave equations have solutions that break down into positive and negative frequencies, right? So the negative frequency ones, they to the naive eye, they look like they should have negative energy, which led to Dirac's puzzle about the whole theory and stuff like this. But in any case, the current way to handle this is to say, well, the negative frequency solutions correspond to the antiparticles, and the positive frequency wave functions correspond to the wave functions of the particles. So that identification is made. And then when we do that, of course, we can define creation and annihilation operators that create and annihilate purely positive frequency or purely negative frequency solutions. Okay, that allows us to define number operators for positive frequency particles and negative frequency particles, so we have particle and antiparticle number operators, right? And so that's usually the way that matter and antimatter are sort of prized apart in a quantum field theory textbook. That's the way the definition is given. But there's a suspicious thing about this, which is we don't get a new definition once those textbooks start to define interacting theories, right? And a lot of things change when you go from a linear, non-interacting free quantum field theory to a non-linear interacting theory. So we might suspect that some things about this definition, you know, get a little troublesome when we make that transition, and indeed they do.
The definition of what?
The definition of antimatter.
Or the number operator. Or...
Right, so the definition of the number operator does indeed become problematic, which leads to problems about the concept of a particle, and this is the source of one of the problems that I want to talk about the definition of what counts as matter, what counts as antimatter. Okay, so here is that first puzzle. Well, good question. Does the textbook definition apply to interacting field theories? You know, it requires a peel of Fox face, and that's going to be the problem that prevents it, really, from applying to interacting field theories. But you might wonder, you know, why is this a problem? Well, free theories are used at the asymptotic scattering limit, for instance. But, they apply perfectly well at that limit. So when we use scattering theory, we use free theories all the time. Of course, this is an idealized, you know, approximation method rather than being something that we can take literally. The slogan goes, you can't really turn the interaction off, right? And what's more, you can't really get infinitely far in space and time from a scattering event. Strictly speaking, when we use free theories at the asymptotic limit, what we're doing is idealizing. We're pretending that far enough away from the interaction is as good as being infinitely far from the interaction. But that can't literally be what's going on. What literally has to be going on has to be in some sense describable by an interacting quantum field theory. Right? So the puzzle is, the textbook definition that I just talked about relies on the particle concept, and this breaks down in interacting quantum field theories. So Dorian Frazier's work is sort of, in a way, the sort of classic work on this, actually, at this point. Hogg's theorem, of course, is the origin of the problem. The theorem that there are many ways to gloss it. One can gloss Hogg's theorem as saying that the interaction picture, strictly speaking, can't be mathematically well defined. One way of glossing it that I like is to say interacting theories in quantum field theory can't really be formulated on Fock space. They can be formulated on spaces that are sort of quasi-Fock in some ways, but the Fock space that we use for free particles is never going to be the same Hilbert space as the one that an interacting quantum field theory for that system ends up in, right? Well, as Doreen has gone to pains to show in her 2008 paper, Fock space is really necessary for a robust particle interpretation of quantum field theory. Some of the conceptual connections, some of the sort of functional connections between physical quantities that you would think would hold between the number operator and the other operators, for instance, they sort of break down when we go outside of Fock space. If we try to define a number operator in the Hilbert spaces for the interacting theories, it doesn't have the properties we would expect. So it doesn't look really quite right to say that the number operators we can define in these spaces are talking about the number of particles. Furthermore, and this is a problem that specifically applies to the matter-antimatter case, in these nonlinear theories, there's no Lorentz invariant way to do what we call splitting the frequencies, that is, looking at the solutions and deciding which of them are positive frequency solutions and which are negative frequency solutions. The reason for this is that you don't have a time-like momentum vector for these solutions. And so you can't say, does it lie in the future light cone or does it lie in the past light cone, which is what we do to split the frequencies. You don't have a breakdown in effect into positive and negative frequency waves. And so since that was something that fit into our naive definition of antimatter, again, you know, it looks like the problems from particles become problems from antimatter. Yeah.
A question about this box space thing. So does that mean that at finite temperature you can't really talk about particles? You know, because I think finite temperature field theory.
Yeah, I think
in some sense an infinite number of particles.
I think that at finite temperatures, the way I would understand it would be the particle picture is a useful approximation to what's exactly going on, but when you look at, you know, a non-zero temperature field theory or something like that, it's, you know, it becomes hard to understand it literally as a theory where you can count the number of particles that are there, for instance.
Well, you couldn't count the numbers because you get an infinite answer. But
right.
But just the intuitive picture, like of a gas or something like that, involves particles, so I'm just wondering how bad this failure.
I think there are many things you could say. Certainly, the particle concept in interacting theories, because they're well approximated in a lot of ways by free theories, is a perfectly good way of understanding them approximately again. So that's a way that we sort of can kind of paper over a lot of these problems. But also, I mean, with the statistical mechanics case, it's not so bad really to think of an, you know, infinite ensemble of particles. So that problem might not be as glaring as the one in the interacting case.
Does the Schwinger model escape?
I am not sure, honestly. Not being very familiar with that model myself. So. Oh, I see.
It has three bound states of permanence.
Yeah, yeah. My guess is that because it's a linear theory in that case,
No, it's not.
Oh, it's not? Okay.
Interact.
Yeah. Oh, right, right. So it's a photon, self-interacting photon is the model. Is that the idea? Or?
No, it's just direct. Massless direct equation in 1 plus 1.
Oh, right. The neutrino. Right. I'm not sure. You know, it's not something in particular that I've looked into there. I don't know. I mean, these arguments have to do with sort of constructive field theories, which are a very tiny subset of the quantum field theories that are used by theorists, the ones that can actually be proven to exist.
That one probably can be done constructively. I don't know.
Yeah, it might be.
It's one of the best candidates for us.
Yeah. So let me say, I mean, the paradigm examples I'm thinking of here are the 5-4 theory in 2 and 3 dimensions and the Yukawa plus P5 in 2 and 3 dimensions, right? So those are the sorts of examples that are going to be important anyway to the argument in the paper. All right, so here is one way that one philosopher of physics has responded to the sort of thing I just said. So David Wallace has a really excellent, actually, 2009 paper on antimatter that, you know, discusses some issues that are sort of, in some ways, orthogonal to what Hans and I are working on, but this is his take. He says, well, look, he wants to, in some sense, sort of hold on to the textbook definition. He thinks, well, matter comes in particle and antiparticle form, so there's an appeal to the particle concept in the definition of antimatter. And he goes on to have this sort of caveat. Well, particles are emergent phenomena. They emerge in the domains where the underlying quantum field, he says, can be treated as approximately linear. Okay, that is the asymptotic scattering. So you combine these two claims that Wallace is making, these two statements he makes, and what you get when you conjoin those things is, fundamentally, there aren't really antiparticles, right? It's only a concept that applies in certain idealized limits. So fundamentally, there's no distinction between matter and antimatter that would follow from this. if the definition, the distinction between matter and antimatter, depends on the particle concept. And this is what Hans and I are trying to react against. We're trying to give an alternative to this sort of answer to the first conceptual problem. All right. This is another problem, you know, a problem that is only sort of the things that make it look like a problem are sort of based on confusions, but it's a puzzle that we got interested in and saw how this DHR picture can give a really satisfying answer to it. Well, here's a sort of, maybe not a standard source, but a pretty authoritative source on all, a lot of different areas of physics, which is Penrose's Road to Reality. You can find similar remarks in various texts, but this one was worded in a way that we liked. He says, for each type of particle, there's a corresponding antiparticle for which each additive quantum number has precisely the negative value that it has for the original particle. So the question we're wondering about is, which quantities take on opposite values when we conjugate, when we switch a matter system into its antimatter counterpart? Well, Penrose says it's the additive quantum numbers. Right? Well, you might wonder, right, which quantities count as additive quantum numbers? Why isn't momentum an additive quantum number? Why is electric charge an additive quantum number? Right? And you might ask further, when I conjugate charge, what's the notion of opposite value of a quantum number that's coming into it? Well, the initial answer would be, duh, it's, you know, take the quantum number, put a minus sign on the front of it. That's not actually what it, you know, how it's going to turn out. It gets more complicated than that, right? So here's an example to show why it gets more complicated than just add a minus sign out front of the quantum number. One of the additive quantum numbers, so additive quantum numbers, you know, in fact, the rigorous version of what they define is they're super selected quantities, right? They're quantities that cannot be super, you know, you can't have superpositions of states that take on different values for an additive quantum number or a super selected quantity. So we know what they are, but how does quantum field theory predict which quantities are super selected quantities, right? How does it dictate the fact that, again, momentum is not a super selected quantity, but, you know, electric charge is? Well, furthermore, right, so that's sort of a continuation of the statement of the little puzzle I was giving you a minute ago. But furthermore, we might think, look, the opposite of a quantum number isn't just add a negative sign on the one you had before you conjugated. An example is, well, the isospin parameter of a particle doesn't change when I take it to its antimatter counterpart, even though this is a super selected quantity, right? The isospin quantum numbers come in half integers. And in fact, if I take, you know, a neutron, say, I take it to its antineutron, you know, I'm taking an isospin 1/2 particle and I'm switching it to a particle that also has isospin 1/2.
But these aren't additive quantum numbers.
Well, so, sorry, isospin quantum numbers?
Yeah.
No, they are, because they're, this is a, so this is a super
total,
selected
this is
quantum
total spin
here.
You're talking.
No, so I'm talking about,
I don't know.
Yeah, total, so this is absolute value. Right, so this is the spin parameter here, rather than like the -1/2 or the +1/2. This is saying, this is an isospin 1/2 particle that could take on either -1/2 or 1/2.
So the
absolute value of. So, right.
So it's j, the one from which you take square root of j plus 1.
Right.
This is what the referent was saying.
You put together two things of isospin half, you don't get something that's a seven of isospin one.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Right. The notion of the word additive here becomes kind of funny. We're using it as sort of a term of art to go along with the super selected quantities, which we think is what these texts have in mind. Right? It's usually, when you ask people a precisified version of what counts as an additive quantum number, they'll say a super selected quantity, which this, in fact, is.
Why do you say isospin is super selected?
So you can't have a superposition of a system that has I suspend 1 half and 1 minus I suspend 1.
That's not absolutely conservative.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is in sort of toy theories where I suspend SU2 symmetry is treated as an exact symmetry. So in theories like that, it's a superselected quantity. Whereas in the actual world, of course, the isospin SU2 symmetry is not an exact symmetry, and so it's not going to be conserved. I should have clarified that. This is sort of treating the isospin symmetry as an exact symmetry.
Why can't you superpose different isospins?
I'm pretty certain that you can't superpose two isospin, an isospin 1 half and an isospin 1. Okay. Let's keep this going. I'm pretty certain that this, in theories where the isospin symmetry is exact, is going to count as an additive quantum number, and it may be that this sort of thing is going to count at least as a superselected quantity, right? Which is what we're sort of using as to go along with additive quantum numbers. Okay, so in effect, what's going on is that the isospin parameter, you know, we treat isospin 1 half as its own opposite. But it doesn't change value when we change from a particle to its antiparticle, even though it's a superselected quantity. So why is that? Well, that's sort of the second kind of thing that we're going to try to answer with this work. Now, the answer is going to come from a connection between group representation theory and the additive quantum numbers of a superselected quantity. So classically, right, we have a connection between conserved quantities, or if they say conserved charges often, and continuous symmetries given by Noether's theorem. Well, in quantum field theory, there's a sort of similar connection between a system's gauge group, by which we just mean its internal symmetry group, rather than, so I'm not in particular talking about local gauge theories. I'm just talking about a group of, a continuous group of internal symmetries here. A system's gauge group is supposed to determine its additive charge quantum numbers, right? So we say the reason why the Dirac electrons take on charges that are in, Z, that are given by integers, well, that's because the gauge group for the Dirac equation is U1. Sometimes it's said that this is true because the integers are the dual of U1. So here's a way of making that notion precise. In this case, by the way, in this abelian case with the Dirac equation, we have the charges given by a group, right? And the gauge group, of course, is a group. But it's not in general going to be the case for all gauge groups that the charges are given by, or that they have the structure of a group, right? So,
can I ask, is it important to you that it be a gauge group, not just a global symmetry of some sort? It's not gauge.
So THR doesn't really make a distinction between it. They use gauge group in a bit of a quirky way to refer to a group of internal symmetries. Right? So it's not important that it be what would more commonly be called a gauge group by a working high-energy particle theorist. Okay, so here's a definition of the connection between the quantum numbers labeling superselection sectors and systems gauge group. Right? So we call this group duality. And this is version 2 of it because in the paper we actually go through a different version 1 that applies only to abelian groups. Well, the claim is that if a system has a compact gauge group G, then the quantum numbers have the structure of the category rep G, which is the category of unitary finite dimensional representations of G. Okay.
To make a theorem out of this, perhaps we would need to have a previous definition of what a quantum number is that is then identified here. Because I would have said that this is almost the definition of what a quantum number associated to the group is.
Right. So we're using this the definition that they're superselected quantities. So here we're saying the superselected quantities, in effect, have the structure of the category ref G. That's the claim of group duality. All right. And what we're
setting this looks like a very simple theorem. It looks like
this is
almost an immediate consequence of the definition.
Right. Well, so what we're looking for is a sort of explanation of why this is going to follow from the definition. I mean, one thing that is definitely not trivial about this is that definition involves representations of G on finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, whereas the Hilbert spaces that we use, you know, in the actual theory are going to be infinite dimensional typically. So one of the things that is more difficult about the DHR proof of this fact is that they have to establish a correspondence between finite dimensional representations of G and the infinite dimensional representations that you'll find in actual physics. Right. So it's not as simple as it appears at first glance. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe I could make it seem less trivial by disagreeing with it. So. Or at least that is something I don't understand here. You're associating quantum numbers just with the equivalence class of the group representation, if I understand.
Right.
If we go back to isospin, say I3 is a quantum number as normally understood. That's not just 1/2. I mean, like in the case of a pion, so it has 3, you know, +1, 0, and -1 charge, which happens to be charged, but it's also isospin. It's the same as the third component of the isospin. And the pi plus and the pi minus are regarded as antiparticles. And so you would expect I3 to change sign, which it does. But I don't see how that fits in here, right? I mean, I3 is a particular component of isospin. It's not a representation as such. So, I mean, this would let you say that the pi triplet is its own anti-triplet.
Right.
But it wouldn't let you say that the pi plus and the pi minus are antiparticles.
Right.
Whereas
right.
The pi zero is its own antiparticle.
So there's a what's going on here is that there's a question about breaking down the in effect the sort of what we're talking about is what we're sort of looking for is a way of defining when a system has all of its quantum numbers reversed, right? So the quantum numbers sort of referred to here are sort of like the totality of values for the quantum numbers in the system, right? So If you have a system with multiple gauge groups, as these guys are using the term, multiple internal symmetries, this is going to give you, well, there's going to be a total gauge group as a result of that. This is going to give you a set of quantum numbers that are sort of, in a sense, pairs of, you know, so if you have something that has the U1 symmetry and
that's the U1, that was a red herring, I shouldn't have mentioned it.
Okay.
Let's just talk about isospin. But I'm saying that I3, the third component of the isospin, seems to have a role here as well. It's what's telling, and maybe it's just a different language that you're proposing, I don't know, but normally people, I think, well, maybe someone can agree or disagree, but I would expect people to say that a pi plus and a pi minus are the antiparticle of each other.
Yeah.
Which is seems to me that's saying more than just saying that the triplet of three pi's is its own, as a triplet is its own anti-triplet. Because it's identifying a particular correspondence.
I see. Interesting. But now in that, so it's funny because the specific example does involve electromagnetic.
It happens to also have
electromagnetic. Yeah. That's interesting. I have to think more about what I would like to say about that sort of example. But in any case, what we're going to end up with from this is sort of an ordered set of all the quantum numbers that a system has, rather than like prizing them apart one by one. So for any gauge group G that's, if you like, a subgroup of the entire internal symmetry group for a system, we can sort of do this work here as well. So you'll end up with, if you take the entire internal symmetry group, you get quantum numbers that have sort of substructures, right, that are the ones you would get if you did the operation.
So you could just take the I3 subgroup and apply it to something.
Just to check that I understood the definition you gave. So your definition of quantum numbers is a set of quantities that completely specify the value of all possible observables that are left untouched by the symmetries, I guess. When you said super selected quantities, I think you meant...
No, these are the quantities that the super selection rule forbids superposition of. Right. Yeah. So they're the ones that all the states in the same super selection sector agree about.
And I guess that a set of quantum numbers is a set of numbers that allows you to predict the values of all these quantities.
Yeah.
And then this theorem is saying that a possible set is given by all possible intertwiners.
This
is the non.
Right.
So is that correct?
Well, it's saying that that the super selection sectors, basically, which are going to turn out to be sort of coextensive with one-to-one correspondence with what we're calling quantum numbers, that those have the same structure as the category of unitary finite dimensional representations. So that's the...
There's one quantum number for each.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Okay.
Arrows is something to do with categories. What are arrows?
Oh, yeah, well, so this part of the definition is sort of there in case those of you familiar with category theory wanted to know what the arrows were on this category, but in fact, you know, we never actually appeal to the arrows here. We appeal to the fact that it's a tensor category. So we're mainly concerned with objects and tensor products of objects. Okay. All right, so... and so this works great if we look at the case where the gauge group is U1, right? Because through this process on U1, turns out the dual is not only a category but also a group of integers. Now, let's say the gauge symmetry is SU2. Right? Well, in this case, if we're looking at a non-abelian group, the dual category of that group is not going to be a group. It's going to be a tensor category, basically. So the category of representations of SU2 is, in fact, a category with a tensor product defined on it. The tensor product is taken to represent composition of charges, right? So if I have two isospin 1/2 systems, I compose them, then 1/2, the 1/2 representation cross the 1/2 representation is going to represent the composite system. Well, one way you might try understanding this, and this is something that's sort of heuristically done, not necessarily, not all of the steps of this reasoning are carried through in textbooks, but this is a sort of reasoning that gets done a lot in particle physics in practice. Well, you might say, this equation, right, so here is in fact the equation for isospin, the tensor product of the isospin 1/2 system and another isospin 1/2 system gets me a direct sum of the system with isospin 0 and 1. You might say, and by the way, something that's going to be of importance here, so I'd like to flag it, is zero is corresponding to the identity on the category. So it's going to correspond to a sort of privileged neutral quantum number which is going to be key to defining the notion of opposites. So it just has the property that when you tensor any other object in a category with the zero object, then you get that object back. Right? So that's why it's the identity on this tensor property. Okay. So here's what I was getting at a moment ago. Does this equation have a natural dynamical interpretation? Well, it seems natural to say that saying when I take the tensor product of two isospin 1/2 systems and I get one out that has either 0 or 1, but this can translate into the claim when two particles with isospin 1/2 collide or something like that, the particles have isospin 0 or 1. The thing is, this interpretation is impossible except as an idealization, because nothing that we've talked about up until now has prevented us from using this formalism to describe free as well as interacting theories, right? So this group duality rule that I discussed applies just as well to free theories, you know, for example, the Dirac electron, as it does to interacting theories. And in free theories, strictly speaking, there are no collisions. So it can't be that, literally speaking, what we're saying when we look at this tensor product is when two particles with isospin 1/2 collide, the products have either 0 or 1. Right? That can't take the full content of that claim, anyway. Yeah.
Can you just explain that equation? Just a simple-minded question, but what does that equal sign even mean? I mean, I just see two. It doesn't mean numerical right. equality. It's
equality as elements of
these two isomorphic spaces, or are they?
Right. So this is in effect isomorphism as Hilbert space representations. So the tensor product of a 1/2 representation with a 1/2 representation equals the direct sum of the 0 and 1 representations, where that equals means they're isomorphic representations.
Right. Okay.
Unitarily equivalent representations.
Okay, so, good.
That's cool. All right. So it applies to the free theory as well as to the interacting theory. So a dynamical interpretation, while it sounds natural, can't be the whole story. Right? In fact, it can't be literally true, because you can't say something like this about physical systems in a free field theory, because particles, in effect, never collide. Well, here's the alternative that we prefer. A compositional, what we call a compositional interpretation of that tensor product. When I take an isospin 1/2 system and I compose it with another isospin 1/2 system to make a composite system, which is really physically what the tensor product corresponds to in quantum theory in general, I get a system that has total isospin 0 or 1. And that can apply for other quantum numbers that take the form of tensor categories. Okay. So I say, look, when two systems of quantum number 1/2 are composed, it's possible for them to form a composite system with either quantum number 0 or 1. What do I mean by possible here? I mean, depending on other, maybe non-charge properties in the system, these are the possible quantum numbers that the system.
Including the mid state of 0.
Yeah. It could, it could end up in a mixed state of 0 or 1. Exactly.
So is composed meant to be a physical operation here? Or is it?
Well, it's meant to be a relationship between physical systems, really. So.
You said it wasn't a collision, so we know.
So what's the relationship between a system consisting of a single electron and a system consisting of a state of an electron, let's say, tensor product with a state of a positron? Well, the electron is a part of the electron-positron system, right? So a composition operation is, in effect, you find a system where the composite systems are subsystems of that system. That's what we mean by composition. It's a sort of relationship saying if this thing is a composite of, if this representation is a composite of a system with isospin 1/2 and another system with isospin 1/2, that means that the systems with isospin 1/2 are both parts of it.
So we just conceptually, it might just be that we just conceptually regard the two.
We regard them as coexisting, you know, in the same possibility. Okay. So that rule works really well. On the other hand, it needs a physical explanation, right? Can we derive it from the formalism of quantum field theory? What we don't want to do is, or what we ideally don't want to do, is what was going on early in the history of quantum field theory with the Eightfold Way and things like that, where they would just, they would say, like, let's look at the representations of this group, and those will correspond to a particle. But we don't want that to be a brute posit, right? We want it to be something that's explained by the underlying field theory. Okay. Well, here's a preview of one way, the DHR way of explaining that. The explanation is going to be the quantum numbers that correspond to the representations of the gauge group are going to correspond one-to-one with superselection sectors. Right? So what needs to be shown is that the superselection sectors correspond one-to-one with the representations of the gauge group. Well, the neutral quantum number is then going to label the sector containing the vacuum, right, the charge zero sector, effectively. And systems that can have quantum number zero when they're composed are going to count as conjugate or antimatter counterparts. So if I take this system, I put it together in the same universe with this other system, and they can have a total charge of zero if I do that, then they're going to count as antimatter counterparts. As some basic vocabulary, just to define some terms I'm going to use in a minute. In the algebraic approach to quantum field theory, which is what DHR is formulated in, well, the observables are given by self-adjoint operators in the C-star algebra, right? Usually this curly A is used. And, well, oh, hey, come on. Okay, all right. Talking to you guys back there, so I suspect it's not going to be the case that every tensor category contains an identity element of that sort. Hans can know the answer to that. One of the unfortunate things about my being is that I'm the less mathematical of the two people who've collaborated on the paper. It's definitely the case in all of the tensor categories that are going to be physically relevant in the DHR picture.
Because there is always a trivial representation of the group.
Right, exactly. Okay. In this AQFT picture, some very general features of it, observables are self-adjoint operators in the C-star algebra. Right, states rather than being state vectors are going to be normed linear functionals, which take that algebra into the complex numbers. Right, so the physical interpretation of these states is that when I apply a functional to the observable A, that gives its expectation value. Okay, so that's how we represent states in this system, which is really the important bit from that. Well, we consider states, right, just what we mean by a superselection sector, we consider states to be in different superselection sectors if they can't be superposed. All right. Now, what does it mean for a state to be in a superselection sector? Well, algebraic quantum field theory gives us a ready-made notion of what it is for a state to be at home in a Hilbert space representation. The GNS theorem associates each state functional with a unique Hilbert space representation. It's sort of its home representation. It's the unique representation where it's given by a cyclic vector is the criterion. And it's going to turn out to be the case. Well, if we want it to be the case that states in different sectors can't be superposed, the way we apply that condition is by saying states from different sectors have different, that is, unitarily inequivalent GNS representations. All right. This can give us an explanation, of course, about why states never change sectors, right? Why the superselective quantities never change their value, since the dynamics is normally unitary. So it's not going to take us from one representation to a different unitarily inequivalent representation. All right. So, physically, the sectors should correspond to the additive quantum numbers because the additive quantum numbers are the things that label the superselection sectors, right? They're the superselected quantities. They're the quantities that don't change among the different states in a given superselection sector. So they should be a sort of label for the sector. All right. And of course, additive quantum numbers are conserved because, as we saw, states don't leave a superselection sector when the unitary dynamics acts on them. So to explain group duality, to explain the fact that the additive quantum numbers correspond one-to-one with the representations of the gauge group, what we need is to show that the physically relevant sectors of the algebra of observables, all right, the physically relevant representations of that algebra, correspond one-to-one with the elements of the representations, with the elements of ref G. Right? And to explain antimatter, what we need is to show that every one of these sectors possesses an opposite, that when we compose the two, we can get the vacuum back, right, or the sector that the vacuum belongs to. Well, here's what DHR do as sort of a bi-force way of getting this result. And it involves a sort of deal with the devil, which is that they apply a physically unrealistic selection criterion. So a selection criterion is a way of looking at the states and representations in AQFT and weeding out the ones that you want to consider to be unphysical for your purposes. So an example of this that's commonly referred to is that when you're doing semi-classical quantum gravity, right, you don't want to have states that don't have a well-defined stress-energy tensor because you need an excitation value for the stress-energy tensor in order to do semi-classical quantum gravity. So applying the so-called Hadamard condition will prevent that problem. It'll restrict you only to states that have a stress-energy tensor well-defined. Well, the DHR method is, let's think up a condition like this, a selection criterion like this, that's physically unrealistic in some ways, but we'll hope to generalize it later to involve more realistic systems. And then once we do that, once we apply this unrealistic selection criterion, we're going to get the explanations of antimatter and group duality that we're looking for. Well, here's that criterion. They say, let's treat representations as physical when they differ from the vacuum's GNS representation only in a finite region. Right? By this I mean, really, when I say they differ from the vacuum's GNS representation in a finite region, I mean outside the past and future light cones of that finite region. Right? So the parts of the system that are space-like separated from a finite region are going to be treated as unitarily equivalent to the vacuum. They say, let's only look at representations like these and call them physical. These form a category that's called delta of A. Right? Just keep in mind, this is the category of the DHR representations that meet this criterion. And like I said, the problem with it is that it's not physically realistic. Electrodynamics violates it, right? Because of Gauss's law. No matter how far away you get from an electric charge, that charge is going to have a non-zero effect on how things are, right? So theories of asymptotic freedom actually can meet this condition. So this is another example of the fact that, in a sense, when we're looking at algebraic and constructive field theory, chromodynamics is actually an easier case than electrodynamics in a lot of ways. Okay. But in any case, I just want to flag the fact that this criterion has some drawbacks. Okay, but let's say we apply it. Well, then we can do basically what group duality does, which is to equate the category of representations of the gauge group with the labels for the superselection sectors, with the quantum numbers. Right? So, basically, Doppelker and Roberts, the DNR from DHR, have a separate theorem that they call the DHR or the DR reconstruction theorem. It has actually a separate goal, but one of the things that it shows is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between every element of rep G and every element of this category delta that gives the DHR representations. Okay. You know what? Isomorphism of categories that takes the form of a functor. So in effect, what the Doppelker-Roberts reconstruction theorem shows is we have this sort of, here's sort of the roadmap. Well, we know that the quantum numbers, right, correspond to the sectors because they're the things the quantities where different values can't be superposed. Okay. The sectors correspond to the DHR representations. That's what we do when we set this DHR criterion, right? We say the only representations we're considering physical are going to be the ones that meet this criterion. And then the theorem tells us that the representations of the gauge group correspond one-to-one with those DHR representations. So you cut out the middleman here, and one of the things that the Doppelker-Roberts reconstruction theorem shows is that the quantum numbers correspond one-to-one with the representations of the gauge group. So group duality, which is what we were trying to explain, follows from this. All right, now we get to antimatter, right? So now we get to the real sort of meat of what we think is interesting for our purposes about DHR. So let's define conjugate representations the following way. Right, we say that X and X bar are conjugate representations, conjugate DHR representations or conjugate superselection sectors, if and only if, when I take their tensor product, I get a direct sum of 0, right, the trivial representation, plus other representations. And I don't care which other representations show up there. All right. And there might be no other representations, so you might just get the trivial representation. Well, in rep G, every every representation of the gauge group has a conjugate, so the same, of course, goes for the DHR representations. And if two states come from conjugate representations, then when they compose, the composite state can end up in the vacuum representation, right? Because when I take a system with quantum number X effectively and quantum number X bar and compose them together, right, I get a direct sum of the charge zero representation with all the other representations, or, with maybe some other representations in there. But in any case, it's possible at the end of the day for the system to end up in the same representation as the vacuum. This means, in effect, the states can annihilate without changing sector because they're in a representation where the dynamics connects them with a bunch of charge zero states. Right? They're not living in a sector that's unitarily equivalent to the one that the vacuum lives in.
You are not assuming here that X and X bar are irreducible representation. Just any
representation. Yeah, just any representations.
Thanks.
Okay. Yes.
Can DHR construct their representations for any non-trivial field theory?
Definitely not for any non-trivial field theory, because...
Not for any, in a different way, but is there a construction for anything other than free?
Ah, yes. That's exactly what I was about to get to. You read my mind. Here's where we're going. All right. Here's a definition of antimatter that we claim applies to at least some systems that don't allow a particle interpretation. Okay, here's the definition. A matter system and its antimatter counterpart are given by states in conjugate superselection sectors. Those, that relationship between sectors I just defined, right, conjugacy. If a matter system and its antimatter system, well, what it is to be a matter system and an antimatter system is to live in conjugate superselection sectors. Okay, charge conjugacy takes you to the conjugate superselection sector. That's what that operation corresponds to mathematically in this framework. Well, this definition applies to all the states that meet the DHR condition. In fact, it can be generalized a little further so far. They figured out some ways to generalize it further. But at any case, even saying that it just applies to the DHR states, that includes at least one interacting model, which is the two-dimensional Yukawa model. Steve Summers showed this in a 1985 paper. So there's at least one system. Yeah.
So do you take into account that when you combine them, you have these other adders, not only the zero, right, but the others as well? So how do you make sure that the vacuum is picked out? This is an initial condition.
Well, right. So in effect, I mean, what? So. We're not sort of, what do I want to say to this? It's definitely not the case that a particle and its antiparticle have to annihilate every time they are put together into a composite system, right? What it is for something to be something else's antiparticle, or for this state to be the antimatter counterpart of this other state, we're saying is that it's physically possible that they could annihilate. Okay, so the fact that the vacuum is there in the direct sum at all is what makes it possible for the two systems to annihilate. Okay, so that's what we're looking for. We don't think it has to be necessary that they annihilate. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, almost done. All right.
Oh, but I think that's the previous slide. It's just...
Yeah.
Did this EHR have a notion of putting together two states of matter, in other words, I mean, that seems to be physically what's behind it. So do you have to write two space-like regions, separated regions, and one system in one and one is the other, or what's the...
Well, in those cases, there's going to be a larger region that the two are proper parts of. So the new state will count as DHR because the regions, you can treat them as double cones, right? You can say, well, if the one charge is in this region, the other charge is in this region, then take a region big enough to include both of them, right? Then that system meets the DHR condition for that larger region.
Yes, it does, but what's the notion of combining two states? So, I mean, the one was supposed to be completely isolated, then it had a representation. The other one was supposed to be completely isolated.
Right.
It had its own representation. So is there a notion of what it says, what it means to combine two of those
sectors
or whatever you call it?
Right, so it's in effect to take the tensor product.
At the group level, it's just tensor product representations.
Yeah.
But physically, I thought they had some way of deriving this all out of field theory. So what is the field theory of the physical operation that corresponds to the tensor product? Of the groups, of the group representation.
Well, it's just supposed to be the operation of it's given this compositional interpretation that we gave it, right? You take the one state, you take the other state, and you generate a system of which the two states are subsystems.
Right? So do they have a mathematical way of doing saying what they mean by that?
Yeah.
That's why I'm questioning.
Oh.
Because they won't, I mean, the two regions will now overlap, right? I mean, if you have the future light cone of this and the future light cone of this will overlap. So they're not, neither one is completely isolated in the sense that you
ended
anymore.
So they're not isolated from one another, but the system as a whole is isolated from everything that's
yes.
outside the past and future light cones of
So, right, so how do you know what it's subsystem? Well, maybe we can talk later, but it seems to me there's a sort of gap in the physical picture.
About where the subsystem is.
What it means to compose distinct sections physically.
I feel like I'm sort of starting to see the point, but maybe I should move on. Okay. All right. So what I was getting at a second ago is there's at least one interacting model that the DHR condition actually does apply to. So there's a case of a system, right? If Doreen's argument about particles fundamentally not existing in interacting field theories goes through, we have a system with no particle interpretation where we can define antimatter. So fundamentally, the question remains, is there antimatter?
Are you going to tell us what this new Kawakubo model is and what are the conserved quantities and stuff?
Oh yeah, so it's just a two-dimensional interaction between charged fermions and neutral bosons, right? So it's normally used to, given that it's in only two dimensions, it's physically unrealistic, right? But the four-dimensional version of it is just used for the strong force interaction.
The selection sectors are electric charged.
Yeah, right. They're going to be, right. Yeah, they're going to be the charges on the nucleons are going to be the super selection sectors there. Okay. So, obviously, right, the restriction to DHR states is unrealistic, like I said before. It has been generalized further to so-called Buchholz-Frenhagen states. The difference between those and the DHR states is that the Buchholz-Frenhagen states agree with the vacuum outside of one space-like cone. Okay, so they're like DHR, except you can add some more space-like coordinates in to the part where the state can disagree with the vacuum. Okay. Of course, that doesn't cover electromagnetism either, right? Because you have people disagree with the vacuum everywhere. So that's an outstanding problem. On the other hand, there's no known obstacle in principle to generalizing the DHR system any further. And, you know, these problems in mathematical physics are very difficult and take years and years to solve. So there's no known reason to be pessimistic, but it's a very hard problem. Right? So it may be that when Wallace says, no, fundamentally, there's no such thing as matter and antimatter, that distinction doesn't apply to fundamental physical systems, he might be right, right? Because you might not be able to generalize a picture like this to cover all of the possibilities in the standard model, okay? But if that's true, it's not because the standard model doesn't broker a particle interpretation, right? It's because the DHR condition is unrealistic, and the BF condition is unrealistic, and we can't generalize this picture further. But it already is more general than the notion of particle. So antimatter doesn't stand or fall with the concept of particles. The proper definition of antimatter is not matter made up of antiparticles. So for further reading on this topic, this is the series of papers that DHR put together, and this is the paper by Doppler and Roberts that gives their reconstruction theorem. Thank you.
Okay, so we already had a little bit of discussion,
yeah.
So I think there is time now for two short questions, and then I would suggest to close the official part of the seminar and to leave for informal discussions on
Okay. Data sets.
So, Chris?
This one should be short. It's a professional question. What parts of the talk, or what you've shown us today, is distinctively philosophical? So what are the philosophical questions here as opposed to some questions that Joe Schmo, physicist, might tackle.
Right. I think the distinctly philosophical question is the question of whether the concept of antimatter is parasitic on the concept of particle. Does the real definition of antimatter depend on a definition of particle, or can it be defined separately from that concept and in a way that doesn't require that concept to apply? So that's
and now why is that question a philosophical question?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about demarcating between philosophical questions about physics and questions in physics is you have to sort of say, I know it when I see it. And I agree with my colleague Larry Sklar that there's no firm line to be drawn about what counts as philosophy and what counts as science. It seems to me that, well, here's the sociological answer to the question. Recent work in the philosophy of quantum field theory has focused a lot on the notion of the failure of the particle concept, which isn't something that's been directly addressed as much in the literature on sort of pure particle physics. So that was why we saw a close alignment with the issues here and the existing literature on the philosophy of physics on related topics.
I guess I'm asking this because it's a little on my mind in that several of us recently had to write interviews for a book that Max Schlosshauer put together.
Yeah.
And so Lucian wrote an interview, and David Merman wrote his answers, and I had my answers. And one of the questions was, what role does philosophy play in questions about quantum foundation? So that's on the one hand, that's sort of, it's kind of on my mind because of that. But also, I had a conversation with Alan Stairs recently, and he was telling me, he said something cute, which I liked. He said physics was above his pay grade or something. Made me feel good. But he said that he saw his role as kind of checking the plumbing of the physicists. So physicists throw out these various concepts, and the philosopher of science comes along and he checks whether all the connections are really there and there aren't any leaks.
Yeah, or
and so I was wondering to what extent that might be part of what you're doing here.
I think that's
are you making up a definition of antimatter that no physicist will ever use?
Oh, I see. That's a whole other can of worms. I mean, one difficult thing about the philosophy of quantum field theory so far is that it's proceeded very much in the sphere of this algebraic framework, which, how many physicists are convinced that that's the correct way to understand quantum fields in the first place? The answer is, a number of mathematical physicists are convinced that that's the way, and outside of that sub-discipline, it's a whole other sort of hornet's nest. So there are physicists whose work we're trying to clarify. How well do they represent the community? I mean, that's a very difficult question. And I think it'll depend largely on how successful this sort of project can be in the future. If there can be an algebraic theory, the standard model, or something close to it someday, then these guys will be, mainstream. But if there's not, it'll be very, very outside of mainstream.
Yeah, Eric, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, that's a good idea, because I can talk to him. So let me ask for a little clarification here. Is the question about cases in which there's not a unique available definition of the vacuum state because there's multiple inequivalent definitions of the vacuum you could give, like in a curved space-time or you know, the difference between the Rindler vacuum and the Minkowski vacuum? Is that what you're getting at? Okay, well, let's see, I'm trying to decide how much I should answer the question. I thought you were asking how much I should answer that. So, regarding the bit about different vacuum states, it may well be that the notion of, that one way that the notion of matter and antimatter is sort of non-fundamental is that it needs to be, it's relative to which state you're considering to be the vacuum. So it might be that if you have a situation like in some curved spacetimes where there are multiple states that would be equally good candidates for counting as the vacuum, there will be a definition of antimatter to go along with each of them, and there's no really fundamental fact about which is the real definition of antimatter, sort of like how it turns out that there's no fundamental fact about which is the real definition of particle. Okay. Let's see.
Haven't you given yourselves the group as to start with? And you're really dealing with representations of your group.
Right. Yeah, so...
And you assume that every state, even the superselection sectors, which correspond to different group representations, group somewhere. So why don't you just take the identity representation of the group as you...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that's the definition of... that was what I was going to say. The other part of the question is that the zero that's showing up in here.
Why wouldn't that apply to curved space? Unless the curved space example is actually outside of your framework.
So one of the things that needs to be put in to as a sort of input to the DHR picture is a notion of the vacuum, right? Because how do we define what counts as a DHR representation? They're the representations that differ from the vacuum only in a finite area. Okay, so if there are inequivalent vacua, then we might encounter a situation where we could have inequivalent definitions of what counts as a DHR representation. Yeah, but yeah, the identity that we're using here is just the identity representation of the gauge.
I suggest that maybe we take David again and
sorry.
Yes, I would conclude here the official parts of the seminar, and we can continue discussing. That means that what we can discuss informally, and that part is not recorded, but we can keep the video link and everything, so it's nothing was to change.
Okay, all right.
Okay, so thanks again.